incorporated into the goals of the project. So, kind of ending, because whenever I talk to scientists about citizen science, the first question is always about the quality of the data. So we think a lot, and I think anyone who runs a citizen science project thinks a lot about data quality issues. So there are some problems. If people enter inaccurate data into our website, people visiting the website might view erroneous data. We don't filter the data before they're displayed on our website. Probably more importantly is we could use those data in scientific publications that aren't accurate. So we need to think about what things could cause inaccurate data. Maybe people can't identify things clearly. Their eyes aren't very good. They can't see an egg and tell it from a little drop of latex on the plant. Or they might make non-random observations. So it's always important to think about how you can prevent data quality problems through good training, being sure to check all of the data that the people enter, recognizing normal patterns, anticipating problems. But what I always say when a scientist asks me about how do you assure the quality of data that are collected by volunteers, I think we need to think about, you know, if you're a scientist publishing data, who actually collected the data that you're publishing in your papers? I think that volunteers aren't necessarily less accurate than the people that usually collect data. At least in my case, the people that usually collect my data are undergraduates who I'm paying about $8 or $10 an hour. So I don't think that we really necessarily
There we go. Insect Conservation, a 1981 article in the Annual Review of Entomology, based its justification for conservation programs on value. We should conserve insects because they provide three basic benefits to humans. One is intellectual, which Pyle and others defined as inspiration for art and aesthetic considerations and their value to biological programs. Economic considerations, and ecological. These three basic benefits are basically an anthropocentric view. Insects are of conservation value because of their benefit to humans. Others offer a different view, such as the interconnected web of life, and contend that all organisms, including insects, have the right to survive. I wish to focus on this latter viewpoint, that insects are part of the interconnected web of life. For this reason alone, their conservation deserves our attention. To further support this approach, I will add ethics to art as justification for conservation. Art and ethics together are the cultural connection. In The Moral Standing of Insects and the Ethics of Extinction, Jeffrey Lockwood developed an ethical basis to justify insect conservation. Do insects, and therefore their conservation, deserve moral consideration? This is not simply what is legal or reducible to religion, economics, or preferences. It's also not a consideration of rights, but it's the process of moral reasoning. Whether insects deserve moral consideration depends upon whether or not there's an ethical basis for this consideration. Lockwood states that one of the most common criteria for establishing an ethical basis is the presence of sentience. And so he defines sentience as the ability to feel pain or experience pain, consciousness, thought and communication with other members of the same species, and awareness of the general world around them. And of course, as entomologists, we know that insects exhibit all these qualities of sentience. And Lockwood concludes that there is an ethical basis for granting insects moral status, and that considering their fate in your lab, in your backyard, in forests and streams, this is separate from their benefit to humans. The moral basis is because insects are sentient creatures, they deserve our consideration for conservation. How often do we make this connection? Michael Samways views an ethical basis as the starting point for an effective insect conservation program. Albert Schweitzer extends it even farther to the concept of the sacred. Our obligation to protect life goes beyond that owed to our fellow humans. It extends to plants and animals that also inhabit our world. Aldo Leopold, in a Sand County Almanac, introduced the concept of the land ethic. He urged humans to rethink their relationship with the earth. Rather than being exploiters of the earth, humans should be the earth's custodians. This quote from the Almanac helps us move from philosophy and ethics to art, making the cultural connection for insect conservation. How can the experiences of beauty or a sense of awe motivate us and many others into action, conservation action? One place that's a great place to start is with the art of Joseph Scheer of Alfred University. He prints exceedingly detailed, high-quality images on specially chosen papers. This particular installation is entitled Moth Book in Three Chapters, and it illustrates 96 moth species from around the world and has 20 channels of sound. This particular installation was displayed last year at the University of Arizona's Museum of Art. This is a stereo sound installation of Western New York moths on Goli, which is a Chinese handmade paper, with the speakers inside the paper, and the speakers transmit recorded sounds of these insects flexing their flight muscles and warming up, preparing for flight. Joseph simply calls them sound prints. What began several years ago as an art installation project has expanded into a more serious biodiversity project. Scheer aims to document each species of moth living in one county in western New York State. Scheer states that most people view moths as the wicked stepsister to butterflies. But when these images of microlepidoptera are blown up to hyperreality, people react in a very positive way. They want to touch them. Scheer has witnessed the same response regardless of the country in which these prints are displayed. In this example, art is transformational. Though first and foremost beautiful and appealing to the eyes and ears, these prints move people beyond sensation. It draws them closer to even touch things before they might have overlooked or feared. The cultural connection has been made. How beauty and ethics combine in a message of conservation is well illustrated in this ad. The beautiful butterfly and flowers draw you in. The connection between butterflies, pollinators, and flowers is made, so their value to the environment. And the message is sealed with a call for protection. Given the ethical basis, we as humans have a moral obligation to protect these conscious, thinking, and aware creatures from doom, particularly as they cannot lobby on their own behalf. Cultural connections can be made through an experience with living insects in a zoo or butterfly house. These encounters can provide a positive first-hand, though highly controlled, experience with live insects, particularly butterflies. Today, there are more than 100 facilities in the U.S. and more than 150 worldwide in where people can experience live butterflies and other kinds of insects. Some establishments have put butterfly gardens at various places. For example, the Florida Aquarium has 4 butterfly gardens, including one on the rooftop. The butterfly rainforest is part of the Florida Museum of Natural History. It flies 55 to 65 species of tropical butterflies. Just outside the rainforest airlocks, the McGuire Center showcases the wall of wings, which captures the eye with thousands of preserved butterfly specimens and photographs. Also, as you come out of the airlock, you can see the McGuire Center's many projects on butterfly conservation. Butterflies have been described as living art. People connect with living art by walking through the butterfly house and then emerge to a wall that broadcasts conservation. As Aldo Leopold stated, it begins with beauty and then moves beyond to something more profound. The growth of the butterfly display industry has led to a livestock supply industry in some places in Central America and Asian countries. Costa Rica Entomological Supply was the first commercial butterfly farm in Latin America. It's a network of small rural farmers who captively rear insects for the butterfly house industry. A mural contest was started in the town of the Costa Rica Entomological Supply, and some of these murals have really strong conservation messages. This one, Acto de la Metamorphosis, depicts man's manipulation of the natural environment, and you see here that insects are the puppets. In El Luto de la Naturaleza, the mourning of nature, butterflies live in an ecosystem that is bleeding and disintegrating into infertile soil. Large, colorful, and compelling, these murals are a constant reminder to the townspeople, and especially to tourists, about the need to conserve and protect butterflies and their habitats. A number of authors, including Robert Pyle and Stephen Kellert and Richard Louv, have written about the extinction of experience, the decline of children's experience with nature. In The Last Child in the Woods, Louv cites a 2002 British study that showed that children could more readily identify Pokemon characters than they could an otter, a beetle, or an oak. Outreach programs, Mace is getting restless in the corner. So that's where the ESA comes in. As entomologists, we can be the starting point for making the cultural connection with children and their parents. Outreach programs, classes, field trips not only help to recruit the entomologists of tomorrow, they help to form insect conservationists of tomorrow. During these experiences, we can explain to children that there is a moral basis for the ethical treatment of insects. We can highlight their beauty and aesthetic value. We can help cultivate that positive experience with the natural world that will help develop tomorrow's activists for insects and the environment. I would like to close with some words from the president of the ESA in 1936, Edith Patch. She was the first woman president of the ESA. And her public address was entitled Without the Benefit of Insects. And she was very concerned about the rising use of insecticides and their effect on bees and other beneficial insects. And I would like to provide a quote where she said, she in her address, she looked at the year 2000 and what would the world be like in the year 2000. And she said that there would be a proclamation from the President of the United States that land areas at regular intervals would be planted throughout the U.S. and maintained as insect gardens under the direction of government entomologists. And they would be planted with milkweed, hawthorn, and other plants that could sustain populations of butterflies and bees. This is a quote. Entomologists in the future will be more concerned with the conservation and preservation of beneficial insect life as they are now with the destruction of injurious insects. She concluded by saying, the fraternity of hive beekeeper will doubtless continue to fight for the life of their pollinators. As for other helpful insects, will defenders of equal zeal rally to their support to the end that mankind may never be without the benefit of insects. Well, Madam President, it may have taken more than 70 years for the ESA as an organization to fully embrace your prophetic words, but here we are, and we are ready to rally with zeal. Thank you.
Today I'm going to give you a brief introduction of sugarcane aphid problem in Louisiana, and then I'll talk about the host plant resistance work that we did, and that was mostly biochemical, and I looked at amino acids in the phloem sap and honeydew. Briefly talking about the aphids in Louisiana, there are two types of aphids. One is white in color, and it's commonly called white aphid or sugarcane aphid, and the other one is yellow in color, which is commonly called yellow sugarcane aphid. So both are easily distinguishable based on their colors. My work focuses on sugarcane aphid, and which is Melanophis saccharii, and for the rest of my talk I will only say sugarcane aphid, and I will not talk about yellow sugarcane aphid. Sugarcane aphid is a cosmopolitan insect pest of sugarcane and sorghum mainly, and it was first discovered in Louisiana in 1999. Other than sugarcane, it's also a pest of sorghum, rice, maize, and several other members of the grass family. As far as its economic importance is concerned, as it's a key pest of sorghum and sugarcane in many parts of the world, So what it does is basically the loss of chlorophyll, honeydew production, which leads to the development of black sooty mold, and it's also a vector of three persistent viruses. So those are the three major problems caused by this aphid. In South Africa, where it's also called sorghum aphid, because the losses due to this aphid are huge if unchecked by the chemicals. In some reports, 46 to 78% yield losses in sorghum have been reported over there. In Louisiana, we don't have direct yield losses due to this aphid. However, losses due to sugarcane yellow leaf virus have been reported as high as 11 to 14%. And because of that, yellow leaf has been added in the certification standards of micropropagated sugarcane. There are several management options available and have been proven effective in many parts of the world. However, we are looking at host plant resistance in this study. Based on our previous studies, we found that population growth rate, there are significant differences among these five commercial cultivars. And we found that L97-128 is the most susceptible cultivar, while HOCP-91-555 is the most resistant cultivar. And there was almost three times difference in the number of aphids that can be produced on 128 than on 555. So the objective of this study was to see if that resistance that we observed in the greenhouse studies also sustains in the field conditions. And we also wanted to identify the biochemical basis of such resistance. For first objective, we planted those five cultivars under field conditions and in a 5-rep test in Youngsville, Louisiana in the summer of 2006. Data was collected in April through September 2007, and it was biweekly data, and from each plot, 10 plants were randomly selected, and the whole plant was observed for aphid presence, and then the number of aphids were only counted on two leaves with maximum aphid aggregation. For biochemical basis of resistance studies, we looked at free amino acids in the phloem sap, honeydew, total phenolics as well as water potential. But since total phenolics and water potential, we did not detect any significant differences between two varieties, so I'm not going to talk about those two things. So for these studies, we only selected L97-128, which was susceptible cultivar, and HOCP-91-555, which is resistant cultivar. For the rest of my talk, I will only say 128 for the susceptible cultivar and 555 for the resistant cultivar. We planted these in the greenhouse, several reps of each one of these cultivar, and then we chose leaf number 4 for phloem sap extraction. We extracted phloem sap with 5 millimolar EDTA solution, and immediately after cutting the leaf that was put into that solution, and for 60 minutes we incubated that in an incubator with more than 90% relative humidity. The samples were frozen at minus 80 degrees centigrade before HPLC analysis. For honeydew collection, we again planted these same cultivars, same number of reps, and we chose same leaf number 4 for honeydew collection. I made this cage, a sticky cage, which it's very simple, just mounting tape plus parafilm, and we confined 15 nymphs in each cage on each cultivar, and then honeydew was collected on this parafilm. Then we had to pull together because in our initial test, we could not detect many peaks. So we had to pull together the honeydew from several different reps. And we dissolved it in 1 milliliter of water, and then the samples were frozen for HPLC analysis. We did HPLC analysis for amino acids in the phloem sap and honeydew, and the data was analyzed for each one of the parameters that I'll mention the results using PROCmix and SAS software. This slide shows what we observed under field conditions, and I have made bold lines only for the cultivars that we are interested, the most resistant and the most susceptible. And we see over here that 128, initially we did not see any, the populations were extremely low from beginning of April till mid-May, and then we started seeing increase in aphid numbers on almost all cultivars, but that increase was never consistent. However, we see that 128 was always significantly higher than other resistant variety cultivar, which is 555. And we see that 555 throughout the season, the numbers on this cultivar were extremely low. And then there was population crash after mid-July, and after that the populations didn't increase. These are our greenhouse results, which show that when we looked at total free amino acids as well as essential or non-essential free amino acids, we did not detect any significant differences for any one of these parameters between two cultivars. This slide shows the amino acid composition as well as the relative amount of each of the free amino acids on both cultivars. And these asterisks indicate the cultivar-specific amino acids. And we see that on the susceptible cultivar, there were two essential amino acids, which is histidine and arginine, that were detected in the phloem sap of 128, while another essential amino acid, which is valine, was only detected from the phloem sap of 555. The most dominant amino acid in phloem sap of both cultivar was alanine. Now I'll talk about honeydew. When we look at honeydew excreted from the aphids feeding on either variety, we see that there was a significant decrease in the amount of total free amino acids as well as non-essential free amino acids in the honeydew than in the honeydew from the aphids feeding on 128, which is susceptible cultivar, than 555. This slide shows the relative amount of each free amino acid as well as the composition of free amino acid while aphids were feeding on resistant and susceptible cultivar. And these asterisks indicate the cultivar-specific amino acids. And we noticed that there were four amino acids that were detected only in the honeydew from aphids feeding on 128, which was susceptible cultivar. We also noticed a shift in the composition as well as relative amounts of amino acids in the honeydew than in the phloem sap, and we noticed that aspartic and glutamic acid were the most dominant amino acids in the honeydew, while alanine was the most dominant amino acid in the phloem sap. Now I will mention what happens when we look at each cultivar individually, and we see a significant decrease in the amount of total as well as non-essential free amino acids in the a decrease in honeydew than in the phloem sap. And this indicates that we observed seven more peaks, and five of them were essential free amino acids that were seen only in the honeydew of aphids feeding on 128, but those were not detected in the phloem sap. What happens on the resistant cultivar? Again, similar trend, a significant decrease in total as well as non-essential free amino acids as we saw on the susceptible cultivar. This shows what happens and the shift in amino acid composition in honeydew than in the ingested phloem sap, and we see that there are four additional peaks, and those are all four are essential free amino acids. From these we conclude that there are four differential amino acids. Two of them are essential and two are non-essential. And we conclude, overall conclusion is that HOCP91555 maintains its resistance status under field conditions, and resistance to the sugarcane aphid is biochemical based, and there are certain particular free amino acids that are only present in the sap of, that are not present in the sap of resistant cultivar, and the aphid feeding on that resistant cultivar is unable to manufacture two essential free amino acids, which are isoleucine and leucine. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you.
No, I cannot make a general statement about that. It varies for each and every aphid.